welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about The Professor's House by Willa Cather. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. Today our guest is Deidre Berzer, who teaches history at Hillsdale College, and she's the director and editor-in-chief of the South Dakota Historical Society Press. She's podcasted with us many times previously, including three times before now on the novels of Willa Cather, and most recently on The Woman in White by Wilkie Collins. She joins us in the studio as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station WRFH in Michigan. Deidre, welcome back to the Great Books Podcast.
Thanks, John. This is absolutely one of my most favorite things to do, so it's so fun to be here.
Why is The Professor's House by Willa Cather a great book?
It really is a different turn for Willa Cather, and I love Willa Cather, and it's a different turn for her, and it's very artsy in ways that her prairie novels that we've talked about before and Death Comes for the Archbishop, I'm not saying they're not artsy, but this really is, she's trying to think about this moment in time in the 1920s, early 1920s, when she's mostly writing it in 1923, it's published in 1925, and really looking at all of the massive changes in the world around her and thinking that maybe not everything that is new is good.
We're going to talk about all of that, the story, the characters, what Willa Cather's trying to say, where this book fits into her body of work, and a lot more. Deidre, let's start with the very first line of The Professor's House, which is this, quote, "The moving was over and done. Professor St. Peter was alone in the dismantled house where he had lived ever since his marriage, where he had worked out his career and brought up his two daughters." Unquote. So who is this guy, Professor St. Peter? Who is this guy and what's going on here?
So Professor St. Peter is at a small college in the Midwest. It's close to Lake Michigan. It's close to Chicago. In fact, the first time my husband and I read this, I think I read it out loud to him while we were driving west somewhere probably. And we're like, this is uncannily like our own lives. Almost, well, it was probably 90 years or so later at that point. So he's been a very successful professor. He's done a lot of great writing about the Spanish colonization of Latin America into what we call the borderlands, Spanish colonial borderlands. And he's got two adult daughters, and money has come fairly easily. And there's the whole backstory to that that's very much a part of the novel. And so his wife has encouraged a move. They've built a house with all kinds of newfangled things, bathtubs and electricity. And they, all of the career, they've been renting a house that has numerous problems, but it's also been the location of all of the most important events of his life. His children have grown up, and it's infused with memory. It's infused as it's his workspace. And for writers, and Willa Cather especially, she had, when she found a place that was a good writing space for her, she did not let go unless she was forced out. And that did happen to her in New York, a place that she really loved writing in New York City, had to be knocked over to make way for highways or subways or something. And so this is his writing space, and he is very reluctant. He's feeling that. And I when I read this novel, I think in so many ways it asks the great conservative question, what is worth conserving? That each generation has to kind of go back and think about that. Okay, what about this place that had its difficulties, including potential asphyxiation from gas stove in his little study? But there are also a lot of really, really good things about that place. And so he's pondering, can I really let this place go?
And so for Professor St. Peter, the moving was over and done, as the first line says, but he is not ready to move on.
And he doesn't. So that's why the professor's house, it stays the professor's house. So he says he cannot move his study until he's finished with a certain project he's trying to get through. And his study has been the same room that was the sewing room. For the many years they hired a woman to come in and sew. I guess that was a normal thing in the 1910s, 1920s. And so the sewing forms, which are kind of like mannequins, were in there with him. It was like they were kind of watching over him, and there was no way he was going to let those move either. So it seems kind of like he's a little irrational about keeping everything exactly the same. But this is his way of kind of working through this move. So, yeah, he hangs on to that house.
So the book is called The Professor's House. There are two houses, and they both belong to the professor. Does the title refer to one or the other or both, or is it ambiguous in this tale of two houses?
I think it's very clear that the new house is not his house. That's his wife's house, and it's structured very much around the sons-in-law, and that's part of the story too, and the things that they think the family should have that are markers, really, of being up and coming in the early 1920s.
So Professor Godfrey St. Peter, he's our protagonist. He's one of our protagonists, age 52. That's a name loaded with meaning, Godfrey St. Peter.
Yes. And lots of the names throughout the book are also very constructed with a lot of meaning in them, I'd say, as well.
So tell us a little bit more about him. It's the middle of his life. Is this a midlife crisis for him?
I'm not sure that, well, I'm thinking that if the move had happened a decade before, it may have been the same. But then again, he is sort of contemplating having finished more or less his masterwork of his life, which is a multi-volume biographies, histories of Spanish explorers, and some capstone things he wants to put on that. And he does kind of contemplate things. He's not a man of religion. His father was kind of moved away from Catholicism, and I think his mother was Methodist, and not much came of that for him. But the pinnacle for him of religion is the sewing woman, Augusta, who comes every morning right after Mass and shapes his day by sharing some kernel of wisdom with him. Well, it's very likely that came from either the scripture readings or the homily from daily Mass. And she's constantly answering questions for him about Christianity and Catholicism in particular.
She's a minor figure in a way, but a very important one, this sort of spinster sewing woman who comes up to dispense wisdom.
Yes, and she's the anchor to the house for him. And I think she represents what hasn't changed, because she hangs on to old world. Her father was an immigrant who owns the house. So he was the landlord, still is the landlord. And there's that part of the house, and then there's the garden that St. Peter constructed over the years that's French, very French. He's got ties to France, and the landlord has been kind of aghast about the garden for years. And those are the two anchors in the house that he watched his girls grow up playing in the garden. He wrote all the books, and they would come off up to his study, and so we get his memories interspersed throughout the book. And Augusta is sort of a pillar of tradition.
There are other important female characters in this book. He's married, he has a wife.
Yes.
There are the two daughters. And the professor has this kind of tension in his life between the life of the scholar and the life of the mind, and then also the life with his family. Tell us a little bit about that, and who are these women?
St. Peter's married to Lillian, who is a very beautiful and accomplished woman. She brought her own dowry in, so she's able to ensure that the family has access to cleaning and someone else to do cleaning and cooking and sewing, so they can live in a way that most professors could not. And that was very important in their marriage and took a lot of pressure off of St. Peter. They have two daughters, Rosamond and Kathleen. They call her Kitty. And these two girls seem like they're the light of his life in a lot of ways. And so we get the memories of them as young girls running in and out of the garden, and they spent most of their time there. And his office window overlooks the garden. And so that's very much a part of his muse, in a way, of his writing, is that the girls are right there. And it's all one big world.
And now they're married and they have husbands, yes. and we meet them. One more quick question about the wife, about Lillian. And this goes back to the bit about this house conflict. He is for the old, she is for the new.
She is for the new.
Right? And this is a tension in their marriage.
Yes. And she's also, as the present time of the novel is when the two daughters are married. And Lillian is very taken with both of her sons-in-law. And her husband, not so much. It's not that he dislikes them. It's just he doesn't embrace them in the same way that she does. And he's kind of surprised that she has opened the family up to these two men.
And so it's a regular family. There's conflict.
It's
normal. Exactly. But not everybody gets along, and there are issues, shall we say.
Yes.
All right, there's one other character we've got to talk about. He's a major character. We've held off bringing him up so far, but he matters a lot. And that's a guy called Tom Outland, Outland, curious last name. Tom Outland, in certain ways, he's the center of this novel, both literally and figuratively. But tell us, who is Tom Outland and what role does he play in this book?
Tom Outland shows up at their door, basically because the priest he was very close to in his growing up years in New Mexico said, after having read Godfrey St. Peter's works on Spanish America and the explorers, that he was the only one who understood the Southwest. And so that was the one tie to academia that Tom Outland had. So he was going to come to this little Hamilton College and be a student of St. Peter's without really knowing anything at all about college. And so he shows up at the door. He's very awkward, and he's also very endearing. The little girls take to him right away. Lillian kind of brings him in, and St. Peter's a little wary. He's not so sure, but he's willing to help. In time, their relationship grows immensely, and Tom Outland is basically part of the family, plays with the girls all the time. He is a rare mind, and we get that from the professor's point of view. He talks about maybe less than once a year, maybe once in a cohort, finding a student that has that kind of mental capacity that a professor can really engage with. And Tom has that.
And he's got a great backstory, too.
Oh my gosh,
this is a guy who's had adventures in the Southwest. So what is his backstory? What was he doing out there that makes him an appealing, small-R romantic character?
He is an orphan. His parents were crossing Kansas in a wagon, and both ended up dying of disease, and a nearby family, who was a railroad family, took him in and raised him. And so he grew up working for the railroad. And his job as a youngster, 10-year-old, 11-year-old, was to see when the trains were coming in and to go find all the crew members that needed to exchange out with the crew that was coming in. And some of them would be in, not at their houses, but in the middle of poker games or whatever. And he had to know the personalities and characters of those men to understand where he needed to go to find them very quickly, because it would be a really fast turnaround, maybe 45 minutes. And so he got to know a lot of really interesting characters this way. And became involved with a cattle group and was hired to watch the herd over the winter. And it happened to be that the winter camp was right next to the Blue Mesa. And this is all in New Mexico.
And this is a great adventure in archaeology.
Yes,
then.
It is. Yeah, and in ancient history. And so this Blue Mesa, it's like it calls to him, it beckons him, and it's so mysterious. The foreman of the cattle ranch says, you know, from time to time, we lose cattle. You have to watch, because they'll cross the river at this one place, and then they'll kind of run up a canyon, and we can't get them back. It was really this kind of inaccessible mesa, like you couldn't find a way in, and the people who had tried had disappeared, you know, come to naught in various ways, and the cattle that disappeared there that were never to be seen again. And so he was cautioned, Tom was cautioned not to explore. And of course, that's exactly what he wants to do, right? He spends his winter trying to figure out how to do this. And then when his work schedule is done with the cattle company, he and his buddy Roddy spend all of their money getting outfitted to go into the mesa and establish a camp. And they do that, and they are amazed at what they find. And what Willa Cather has described here is actually Mesa Verde. This is the story, Tom Allen's story, is of the guy who discovered it.
And so Blue Mesa is fictional, but it's a stand-in for Mesa Verde.
Yes.
And what is Mesa Verde? In real life, in our world, Mesa Verde is what?
It's in the southwestern corner of Colorado, and it was the home of Anasazi, we assume, and probably the ancestors of the Pueblo peoples of New Mexico. And they were cliff dwellers, and they carved out homes. It was very defensible because no one could get in without being seen.
And this, of course, is a great – this is an amazing national park now.
Now,
this,
yes.
This cliff-dwelling place, this civilization that existed. And of course, there are sites like this across the Southwest. Mesa Verde is maybe the most famous, most picturesque. But Blue Mesa is based on this.
That's right.
And there's a moment then when Tom Outland describes what – he found there, and I'll just read the passage from the professor's house. It's this, quote, "I knew at once that I'd come upon the city of some extinct civilization, hidden away in this inaccessible mesa for centuries, preserved in the dry air and almost perpetual sunlight like a fly in amber, guarded by the cliffs and the river and the desert," unquote. Nice bit of writing, Willa Cather. Congrats. But take us along on the story then. What role does Blue Mesa play in the book?
So Tom, untutored as he is, understands what a find this is, and he is just captivated by it and really feels this connection to the people who live there, tries to figure out what happened. They could tell from looking down at the ground that there were irrigation canals. He kind of figured out that there must have been farm fields, that the people would come down in the summers and work the fields. And so probably they were attacked while they were not on the mesa, because that's one of the main questions, like, what happened to these people? And it did look like they had just kind of left in the middle of things. So he's able to find really intact artifacts everywhere he looks, and he records them very carefully. And so he wants this place to be honored and cared for and studied. And so he goes to Washington, D.C., and he knows about the Smithsonian, and he thinks, okay, those are the people that have the knowledge to take care of this place. He goes to D.C. and has what one might say is a typical D.C. experience, where he is waiting and waiting, and he learns he has to meet the right people and kind of take them out to the right restaurants for lunch in order to get heard. And it takes him months to finally get to tell his tale, and then they don't care.
Willa Cather's portrait of D.C. is really interesting, isn't it? It's negative. It's well, tell us about it. What does she say? What does she tell us about Washington, D.C.?
Tom is horrified at the lives that people lead, that he thinks he sees them all going in at the same time to these buildings. And then they all come out, and the ones he's met are all about ambition and keeping up appearances and spending money they don't have in order to keep up those appearances and attempt to move up in this bureaucracy. And it's just really disheartening picture of humanity. So here's Tom trying to find out everything he can about this ancient civilization that just seems magical to some, in some ways, to him. And then there's this contrast with the people who live in D.C. and the lives that they're leading, and he thinks that they have really lost an aspect of being human.
Deidre, I want to talk about a couple of themes of The Professor's House in just a moment, but first we got to talk about the construction of this novel. There are three books in it, three books within the book, three parts maybe, two framing parts, a middle section that's all about Tom Outland. Critics of this novel say that it's unbalanced. The parts are of varying lengths. Others say this is a brilliant work of modernism. Explain to us how this book is put together and what you make of it.
So the three parts are the family, Tom Outland, and the professor. So the family and the professor bookend Tom Outland. And I think the structure is supposed to show the importance of Tom Outland, that it's outsized, both in the pages of the book and in everything that happens to the family from the moment they meet him. He plays that big of a role. So a little bit after the publication in 1925, Willa Cather is in a conversation with a college English association about contemporary literature and its place. And she defines contemporary literature as anything written by an author who's still alive. And she talks about how she structured this book and that she was trying to get at the life beyond or something that had more meaning beyond. And she was really taken with some Dutch paintings she saw in an exhibit in Paris that depicted living room, living space, but a window, and the window showed ships in the harbor coming and going. And so you get that kind of the close-in family domestic space, but something far beyond and suggestive of the entire world in a sense. And so she was trying to write something that reflected what she saw in those paintings.
And so we have a professor who metaphorically, I guess, is looking out the window all the time from his from his study. And so let's get into a couple of the themes. So Professor St. Peter has this tension between old and new, the old house and the new house. And then we have Tom Outland, who, of course, is a modern figure, but is exploring the past, looking at an ancient site, dealing with artifacts also. Bring this together for us, the old and the new. What is Willa Cather trying to say?
So Tom literally brings the old into the new in a sense, because after this fiasco in the Smithsonian, he goes back to the Blue Mesa only to discover that his partner, Roddy, had sold all of the artifacts to a German antiquities dealer for $4,000. And he was so proud of what he had done, but he didn't understand what the connection that Tom had with it. It wasn't a monetary value. And I think that is the center of all of this. Everything seems to be monetized. And that's the movement into the modern. And St. Peter is fighting that, kicking and screaming.
Tom is like an archaeologist who wants to study and understand and preserve this place. Meanwhile, he's dealing with someone who's basically a fortune hunter, a pot hunter.
But they had a really deep friendship. They just weren't the same kind of person. And so when Tom reacts, as one might expect, to what Roddy has done, Roddy disappears. And Tom spends a lot of time and energy trying to find him. To no avail.
What does the book say about the place of the cliff dwellers and the American Southwest in our national identity? Because another tension of the book is the Midwest, the Midwestern setting, but then so much of this really interesting stuff takes place in another area.
I think that Cather, she pulls in the Southwest in a number of her novels, and that it's got this foundational place in American history that it's largely forgotten because everything is so focused on the New England colonies, and a lot of that moves into the Midwest, right, as the fledgling country expands. And so what happens in the Southwest is really, really important, but it's not part of the picture.
It almost has its own origin story that's different from another part of the country.
Yes, but it's part of the contiguous United States. And so it does have this. And we know now that the trade networks among the Native Americans throughout the country were really tied in with the Southwest because there are objects that have been found and the mounds at Cahokia and all over the place that of things that could have only come from there and even further down to Mexico. So massive trade network. So we're the ones who have forgotten that history. It's there. Those ties were there long ago. And so Tom has this wonder and curiosity that you can't put a price on. And he thinks it's got to be preserved for future generations, right? If you're thinking about what's worth conserving, Mesa Verde, or for them, in the book, Blue Mesa is one of those things. It should be kept intact. And even he brings in, at one point, the priest who had been his Latin tutor and really the source of his education. And the priest says, okay, this area was probably like a plaza, and it's really important, so don't touch it, because we need to let the experts, the people who know what they're doing, come in and dig around in there. And so there's that feeling of Tom can only go so far with the education he has. He needs more education, or he needs, first he goes to people who do have that education. He's rebuffed. So when he can't find Roddy and he doesn't want to touch that money, he just puts in the bank, he goes seeking Professor St. Peter.
And yet, unfortunately, Tom is doomed.
Tom is doomed. But that's part of his honor and his character, is World War I breaks out, and this same priest comes to visit in this Midwestern college town, and he's from Belgium. He's visiting on his way back home to Belgium to offer his assistance however he can. And Tom immediately, I'm going with you. And that nobility of character really appeals to Tom. That's the right thing to do. And of course, he dies in battle very quickly.
And so this great figure doesn't survive into the modern era.
Right. And as a student, though, he's created some kind of gas that he sort of worked with the chemistry professor kind of in that lab. He doesn't, he patents it, but he doesn't get around to figuring out how to manufacture it before he goes off to fight in World War I. And so that actually becomes this huge moneymaker. The people who come after him are able to manufacture it. And so there is a fortune tied up with Tom Outland that has nothing to do with the Southwest.
And it winds up enriching the St. Peter family, creating even more tension about old and new, and what the professor studies, and the way modern commercial life can benefit him and build him a new house.
Yes, because the oldest daughter, Rosamond, is engaged to marry Tom, and she is his heir. So when he dies in the war, that patent goes to her. And the man she ends up marrying, Louis Marcellus is his name, he ends up figuring out how to market this gas. And he's really good at that kind of thing. And they become very wealthy. So that money goes to, not directly to St. Peter, but to his daughter.
Ultimately, this book is not for the old or for the new, is it? It doesn't favor one over the other. It shows us the attraction of both, the problems of both, I think. What do you make of it?
I think it's a really great book alongside some of the other books written in the mid-1920s, just trying to figure out this new moment. Like, what do we bring with us? What is really shallow? It's 1925 is the publication date. That's the same year as The Great Gatsby. I think The Great Gatsby is a lot more cynical about the American dream and the shallowness. I think the characters that Willa Cather portrays are not shallow like that. I think they really are wrestling with a lot of things. And the two daughters, as adults, they have very different husbands and very different lives. The one without the inheritance from Tom Outland, Kitty, is very jealous of her sister in a lot of ways. And so we kind of see how that the problems that the money brings. And I think that's part of why St. Peter's tries to distance himself from that, because he in some points he starts thinking it's actually a good thing that Tom died in the war, because this seeing what his invention created in terms of problems with money and people's relationships would have killed him.
Let's wrap up with a few concluding questions. We've podcasted three times previously on Willa Cather, on My Antonia, O Pioneers, and Death Comes for the Archbishop. Where does this book, The Professor's House, fit into her larger body of work and her legacy?
This one, her muse, Edith Lewis, says was the most personal to her. And she also said it was the one that professors liked the most. And she's writing in the early 1940s, kind of a retrospective. So this one is, it's not of the Prairie novels. It's this, a very different turn in 1925, but this is before she wrote Death Comes for the Archbishop. So she's starting to take her writing into a more creative space, in a sense. Like she's playing with structure, she's playing with image, but also like that she has this point she's trying to make. Now, when she writes about what she's done in this book, she's focusing on that larger meaning beyond, right? And so reading it with keeping that in the back of my head, you know, it's not a beginning, middle, end kind of story. It's more of this kind of introspection into the professor and trying to figure him out in some ways. And he's a very complicated character. So in toward the end, there's this, I mentioned this problem with the gas stove in his study, and you have to have the window exactly right. And this is the window that Cather has constructed the whole piece about his study around this window, right? The one from the painting and the Dutch Masters, where you're looking through the living room into the harbor. And it's this room that is kind of the source, the lifeblood for him, but also it can kill him, and it almost does.
And this is where Augusta comes back in and plays a key role at the end. Well, let's not give the spoiler here, but there's an important moment.
And the reason I'm getting really close to the spoiler that I'm trying not to spoil. So he thinks then, oh, well, okay, this is my time. I'm not going to do anything about it. And is ready. But that's not to be his life, you know. So then he's able to kind of think through, well, you know, maybe things aren't as dire in this situation. And so he comes to a good balance. And I think that's a key difference from a lot of these 1920s novels, where people are dealing with disillusionment and the shallowness of modernity. And you get the sense there is no balance. But Cather brings us to a balance.
One more question, maybe with a couple of parts. Dieter, the book is called The Professor's House. You just said professors seem to like this one the most, or they like it a lot. I know you like it. You teach here at Hillsdale College. Your husband is Brad Berzer. He teaches here at Hillsdale College. He's been on the podcast before. He'll be on the podcast again, as will you. And do you recognize this book as a teacher? I mean, you live in a professor's house. You know, what might you say about Willa Cather's depiction of it, and, you know, the reality of what it's really like? And then finally, why should we read this book now?
So, yes, I live in a professor's house. I think probably the books that are the double rows of books on all the bookshelves probably give that away. Books everywhere. And I'm thinking of our office upstairs and window into the backyard, and maybe we need some of Augusta's forms in there to give us more of a connection to the 19th century. I'm not totally sure. But yeah, I mean, some of the things that really resounded reading this book for the first time some years ago, I was trying to remember when, at least 15 years ago, there's some funny academic politics, and you read it and you think nothing has changed. Academia is exactly the same. There's a lot of rivalry and jealousy of the success that Godfrey St. Peter has had with his books. And then there's jealousy about the money that came in, and the professor who was in that science lab sends his wife over begging. And, you know, so there's definitely this kind of continuation of professor economics in some sense, and professor jealousies and rivalries. But also that his take with the students and trying to find those, connect with those who really want to learn for the sake of learning and for the good life. And he lives for them. And I think that has never changed. And I think that probably from Plato and Aristotle on, that teacher-student connection all around the beauty of learning is really well captured with that relationship between Tom Outland and Godfrey St. Peter. And I think that love of learning is really why we should read it now. It's a beautiful portrait of a man trying to grapple with all of the changes around him and not lose what's important. But, you know, he has to think about, well, what is important and why? And I think that is really important for us these days. Not everything is worth hanging on to, but there are a lot of things that we really should not let go of.
Deidre Berzer, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about The Professor's House by Willa Cather.
Thanks, John. This has been a lot of fun.
You've just listened to The Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to The Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through my website at haymiller.com. On Twitter, my handle is @haymiller. Last of all, special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of The Great Books Podcast.